This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Panos Karan grew up with a piano in his home. Dad loved music, played it for fun. And then when Panos began piano lessons at the age of 7, really nobody would know, and not at that time anyway, that he was about to become an acclaimed concert pianist. Panos Karan has visited more than 100 countries and tries to spread classical music to the most remote locations on the globe. He's in North Carolina to perform with the Chamber Orchestra of the Triangle. This Sunday, they're going to present 3 Viennese Masters featuring the work of Haydn, Beethoven, and Mozart. And Panos Karan joins us right now on The State of Things. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be here.
Quite an odyssey. Take us back to your childhood, because I understand that early on in your musical career, you had a teacher who was not very encouraging.
Well, yes, it was a problem at the time. I had a piano teacher at the very beginning, and I couldn't tell why I wasn't very happy with the way things were going, and I asked to change piano teacher. When my parents called the teacher to say, well, you know, Panos is changing teachers, she said, no, that's fine, I understand, you know, it happens, just to let you know that I don't think Panos will continue playing the piano for very long.
What do you think it was? I mean, I just want to stay there for a minute, because so many kids take lessons, their parents have hopes for them, and that kind of chemistry can really throw a kid off, and if they didn't get the new teacher, they stop. I mean, what do you think is going on there?
I think the responsibility of a piano teacher, of any music teacher, is huge, kind of like a parent almost. It's not only about teaching how to play an instrument, but it's the responsibility of opening up a whole new world, the world of music. But it's not only about music. It's each student is so different. It's the way each person learns is so different. So, as you said, it's about chemistry. It's about 2 people being able to work together. It doesn't mean that if that chemistry doesn't work, it doesn't mean that the teacher is bad. It's just they need a different type of teacher. And unfortunately, there are teachers that they take this very personally, or they think there's only one way of teaching, and that can cause a lot of harm for young people.
What got you interested in piano?
There was a piano at home. My dad always played sing-alongs, you know. My parents always took me to concerts. When I was 7, I asked for piano lessons. Within the first week, I walked out to my dad and I said, I'm going to be better than you. And he laughed and said, well, of course, you know, practice and you will. As soon as I started learning the piano, there was nothing in my life that would complete me, fulfill me as much as that.
And was it classical music?
Yes, classical music.
At the time. When did you realize that you really, really and truly were on that kind of a path, that you had some great talent?
I don't know if I ever realized I had any great talent, but I knew there was absolutely nothing else I wanted to do. I knew that playing music for people was something very important, something very powerful. Even at the age that I didn't exactly know why, and I went through music education. I studied the piano at the Royal Academy of Music in London, and still at that age, at the age of 18, 20, 22, I didn't really know why I'm playing music. You don't walk around a place like the Royal Academy of Music, or I don't know, Juilliard or something like that, asking questions like, why do I play music? And this was an issue. I knew I loved music so much. I knew there's so much that can be done, but I just didn't know why. And it wasn't until actually late in my 20s, after I had actually completed some of the goals I'd set out to achieve, like playing in certain places like Carnegie Hall. This was a really, really big goal of mine. And I achieved it for the first time when I was 25. And it was tremendous experience. Yet it still didn't answer my question, why do I want to play music? All this time I had planned music making in my head as a concert pianist in the center of the stage, and people putting on the nice clothes, buying an expensive ticket, right, hopefully right, clapping at the right places, and all these things were so important for me. It still didn't answer why I want to play music. So it wasn't until later in my 20s that I started leaving temporarily the concert halls behind and traveling to faraway places like the Amazon, Sierra Leone in West Africa, post-tsunami Japan in 2011, and trying to play trying to reach audiences as far away from the console as I was familiar with, that I started seeing with my own eyes what music that I loved so much, classical music, can really do.
I want to talk more about those travels, where you've been, what you've seen, and the audiences you play for. But what made you decide to do that in the first place? As you say, you're not quite sure yet what the heck you're doing this for. What made you think going to Patagonia would be the answer?
I think I went through a period that a lot of musicians go into the late 20s, early 30s. You work so hard, thousands and thousands of hours. We're talking about before the age of 30, I had completed 30,000 hours of practice. And this is not unique. Any musician would be doing the same thing. And you're doing it so much to please an audience, of course, and that's good. But you also programmed in your head so much to please Beethoven and Chopin and Liszt, and these people are dead. You're never going to please them. It's good to try and understand what they wanted, but you're never really going to please them. And it's a fast track to depression. And this is something that's not talked about. The mental health of musicians worldwide is a big issue. So I ended a period in my life, my late 20s, that I really was not happy. I was in depression. I was not enjoying what I was doing. I was nervous on stage. I was not getting the satisfaction that I always dreamed I would be getting being on stage. And it really crossed my mind that I should, you know, while I still can, start all over, do something completely different. Luckily, before I did something so drastic, I did something maybe even more drastic. I don't know. I carried on doing the same thing, playing the piano, but right, changed the rules of the game, changed the location, changed the audience, just to see what would happen.
So let's talk about some of those stories. You bring music to people in what we might consider underserved areas. You literally took a canoe down the Amazon with your keyboard?
That was the first trip. That was in March 2011. I basically traveled to Ecuador with my best friend being the keyboard, and I really didn't have a lot of money at my disposal, very, very little money. I found the cheapest guide that I could find that was familiar with the communities. I packed the keyboard and a generator and a tent and just literally sailed down the Amazon, or what is the source of the Amazon River in Ecuador, and went to some really remote places. With the purpose of playing music, I would arrive to this place and say, "Hey, you know, my name is Panos. I come from Greece. I play this instrument. It's called the piano. Would you like to listen?" And I took it from there. This was the beginning of something, of a new chapter that was completely magical. It was the beginning of a realization that there's so much that can be done with music. Not only reaching and playing for remote audiences, because this was the Amazon case, but that continued in places like, as I said, Sierra Leone in Africa, in post-tsunami Japan, and that opened the chapter of working with young musicians, working with children around the world, and using music to empower them, to give them hope in life, to give hope in human interaction, to give them trust in themselves, trust in others, trust in adults, which in many cases, it's the adults that have really let down the children, and music can really restore all these things.
But it is a particular kind of music that they may not be familiar with. So for instance, in the Amazon, when you said, my name is Panos, I'm from Greece, I play this instrument, would you like to listen? Did they like to listen? What was the response?
I think they really did, and I really came face to face with that realization. I was so used to playing for an audience that understands, you know, when I say I'm going to play music by Bach or Beethoven, more or less they understand on what this is all based on. But I clearly remember the first performance I did there, and it was so hot, and I'd never had to live in a situation without running water and electricity and sleep in the tents and so many bugs and all. Anyway, all these things didn't matter. I put the keyboard up, I plug everything in, and I turned in my little Spanish. I said, you know, I'm about to play a piece of music by Johann Sebastian Bach. And as you'd expect, absolutely nothing happened. There's this group of young people staring back at me, and I remember the teacher very politely steered me in the right direction and said, "Excuse me, can you help us understand what that is?" and of course, I couldn't take for granted anything. Right. I you know, the music I loved so much could be rejected at any point. Me being the messenger of the music could be rejected at any point. But having this pressure added on in the communication made it so much more refreshing for me. And I could say it was the first time I felt real acceptance from an audience.
Well, you know, in some ways, I mean, any of us who have done this kind of teaching abroad, I've done some of this in journalism, and what the thing that I noticed, and I wonder if this happened in your case as well, I've been doing this business for a long time. Now somebody's asked me to teach it to people who are learning it for the first time, and I'm forced to explain why we do these things. And it's been a long time since I thought about that. And in doing that, it gave me a sort of renewed and refreshed love for the business that I was in, because it'd been a long time since I asked myself, why do we do it that way? And how else can we do it? Was that any part of what was happening with you?
You're absolutely right, Frank. I think some people are going to hate me saying this, but there is a certain elitism in classical music. And that comes from the audience, but I think it comes mostly from the performers. We are expected to be playing very serious, very important music, and everybody should take us very seriously. And the truth is, it's music. It's music that is supposed to entertain more than anything. People are booking times in their busy lives, and they're going to go to a theater or somewhere where music is being played, in a concert hall, and they're going to sit for an hour or 2 hours, and they want at the very least to have a good time during this period of time. But I think it's our responsibility as musicians, as you said, to explain better what this is all about. And yes, it is entertainment. It is an emotional journey. And, in rare cases, it is the lives of the audience that are changed because the music really, really touches them. But in order to do that, I think the performers need to realize and communicate that the most important element in music making is actually the audience. Without an audience, you cannot have music. If the audience stops listening to music, our music won't exist anymore.
You had a pivotal moment when you were performing in Japan after an earthquake and tsunami. Tell us about that.
This was the most powerful musical interaction I've had in my life. This was an audience that was going through the worst days in their lives. They'd lost family members, they lost their homes. So I arrived in Japan about 6 months after the earthquake and tsunami of 2011, the nuclear accident in Fukushima. And in one of my interactions in the emergency shelters, I was playing the piano, I was playing music for a group of people that were survivors that had been through really a lot. And this older gentleman came to listen, and he was very shy at first. He didn't seem to be responding too much to the music. By the end, he'd gotten really emotional, and he came up to me and he really tried to express what he was feeling, and he was crying, and he kept, eventually all he said was thank you. In many different ways, he expressed a very strong sense of gratitude. And of course, I was humbled to hear him say that, and I was very emotional also. Only to find out as I was leaving that particular gentleman that expressed himself so emotionally, so vividly, he'd been living in that shelter for 6 months. He'd lost family members, he'd lost his home, but more importantly, he hadn't spoken to anyone for 6 months. I was told it was the first time that people heard him speak, basically. And seeing that it was music that could do that, I personally felt if I had to practice 30,000 hours to reach that point in my life to share that with a human being, it was worth it. But in a bigger picture, I really saw what music can really do for people.
How does this work with younger audiences? Because I know you try to reach kids, and again, in these places where they may or may not have had much exposure, you know, can you, in the brief time that you're there, transmit this? How does it work, and what have you seen?
It absolutely works, and it works mostly when young people, when children are actually involved in music making. So I'm running several programs now in Japan, in Mexico, in India, where I'm looking after young musicians that are learning and playing music. There's something very powerful that very underappreciated in a group of people coming together to rehearse, prepare a program. The safety that these people feel, it helps them see the world differently. I cannot just go there and hand it to them. They have to work for it. So when they come on the stage after having worked hard, and these are a group of kids from a slum community in Mexico or a group of kids from an orphanage in Calcutta in India, these are kids that are used to being seen as garbage. And they come on the stage, and for the first time in their lives, they're not seeing as garbage, they're seeing as musicians. They experience a success that can really shake and move their lives. And this is the vision and the message of the organization that I've put together called Keys of Change. And we work with young people for that particular reason. We're not trying to create the future generation of top musicians, not at all. We want to help young people feel empowered, change their lives through music.
Panos Karan is the founder of Keys of Change. He will be performing with the Chamber Orchestra of the Triangle Sunday at 3, the Carolina Theater in Durham. They're going to present three Viennese masters featuring the work of Haydn, Beethoven, and Mozart. You got to hand it to the Austrians for convincing the world that Hitler was German and Beethoven was Austrian, don't you? Anyway, three Viennese masters. It's fine. You're fine. It's great. It's going to be a great. It's all great music. And we've got that information at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you so much for being on the program. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.